the way that we actually look at the world is by palpating it every 250 milliseconds, four times a second, and we're only able to see a very small part of the world any one time. So we have to now stitch this together, and the way that we stitch this together is by predicting what would I see if I looked over there, and I have a prediction of what I would see over there, and if I'm right, then I can accumulate the evidence for my internal construction, my internal hypotheses, explanations for objects that are out there.
Carl Friston, welcome to How the Light Gets In.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here.
So could we start with a basic overview of the idea that what we take to be conscious experience of the world is really a prediction generated by the brain of the data that it's going to receive from the world? Can you just give a basic overview of what that idea amounts to?
Absolutely. You could probably trace that back to the days of Plato, but to my mind, the most beautifully articulated by Helmholtz in terms of the notion of unconscious inference. And what it was basically proposing was that the brain is a very constructive organ. It's an organ that generates predictions, hypotheses, fantasies, explanations that best explain the sensory impressions on our sensory organs, our eyes and our ears and our bodies. So this is very much, as people like Neil Seth and Andy Clark would say, this is very much an inside out, a very constructive, active process of generating predictions, as opposed to an outside-in process of passively absorbing data. So the idea is that if I've got a good grip on the world, if I'm doing good sense-making, then I should be able to predict exactly what is arriving on my sensory epithelia. In other words, if I'm tracking the world in the right kind of way, there will be no prediction error, there'll be no mismatch between my predictions and what I'm actually sensing. And that leads to the notion of predictive coding, the imperative to minimize one's prediction errors, or more generally, the mismatch between what we predict should happen, the way that the world is unfolding, and the sensory evidence that our predictions are correct. And if they're not correct, we have a prediction error, and then we have to update our beliefs and our expectations about the world.
Sure. So someone sort of intuitively might think that what happens is you get sensory input and then you construct the world on that basis. But you're saying it's the other way around. You first construct a prediction, then you get sensory input, and then what happens?
Well, you test that sensory input against your predictions. Literally, you can subtract them. Your brain cells can literally subtract what's coming in and what you thought should be coming in. And then the difference is the newsworthy information. It's a bit you couldn't predict. And then those prediction errors, the surprising, if you like, sensory information, are used then to update your beliefs, to drive changes in your brain, literally changing your mind so that you adjust your model of the world, sometimes referred to as a generative model or a world model, to then generate better predictions that are a better fit to the world.
Okay, and why is the brain doing it this way around? What problem is it solving by doing this?
Well, it's a solution which I think you nicely put, it is an inversion. Dan Dennett would call this a strange inversion. The problem it solves is the fact that we do not have access to the causes of our sensations, very often articulated in terms of the brain is skull-bound. It lives in the dark. It just has a very sparse set of information through our sensory organs, sampling the world, very small parts of the world, all the possible things we could sample. So take a particular example, scene construction, vision. Now, the way that we actually look at the world is by palpating it every 250 milliseconds, four times a second, and we're only able to see a very small part of the world any one time. So we have to now stitch this together, and the way that we stitch this together is by predicting what would I see if I looked over there, and I have a prediction of what I would see over there, and if I'm right, then I can accumulate the evidence for my internal construction, my internal hypotheses, explanations for objects that are out there. You don't have direct access to what's out there, so in a sense you're solving the problem of living in the world where you only have a very limited access to the actual causes of your sensations.
I see. And so does this mean that we never really access reality outside of our heads. We're always somewhat trapped within our own heads.
We are indeed trapped within our own heads in many senses. Absolutely. I mean, this is not to deny the fact that there is some metaphysical world, some universe out there. But perhaps a nice way to think of this is that there's the world out there, which we will never know. And then there's the world on the inside, our brains, our neuronal dynamics. And they somehow become mutually entrained. They become synchronized in a way that knowing the brain state will tell you something about the state of the world that's generating the sensations. And the way that that happens is that the two systems, you know, me and the rest of the world, talk to each other through this sense, through the sensorum, through our sensations, through our vision, our hearing, our feelings. So everything plays out at the level of sensory impressions, sensory information. And that's where the prediction gets into the game, that if you can, on the inside, always keep track of what's going on just by predicting what you're sensing, ultimately you become synchronized with the outside world. So they're separate, yet fundamentally joined together through the sensorium.
Yeah.
So, you know, which is the reality? Well, it's your reality on the inside, because there might be another reality, but I don't only ever really know that if there's somebody else observing the same reality, and magically we could somehow communicate that to each other.
And this is captured in this phrase that perception is a controlled hallucination. It's the hallucination in one sense, but it's controlled by the external world.
Just to push back a little bit, I know exactly what people mean by that. But the control, I think, sort of slightly gives you a false impression. It's not that reality is controlling what's going on in the inside. This is genuinely a balanced dance. It's a mutual entrainment. And that, I think, is very nicely evinced by the fact, well, let's just take vision again. You know, I choose what I am sampling. So I am actually causing my own sensations. So there's I would replace control with entrainment. I don't know if you remember Huygens' clocks, this notion of generalized synchrony. So Huygens was, I think, a 17th century, possibly 18th century theoretician who observed that if you went to a clockmaker's studio or workshop, after a sufficient period of time, two clocks suspended from the same wall would suddenly come, or not suddenly, but would eventually come to swing in synchrony. And this is called generalized synchrony or synchronization of chaos. And what it says is that the only solution, the only, from the physics perspective, free energy minimizing solution for something that is loosely coupled to something else is this entrainment and synchronization. So this is, I think, what people mean by controlled hallucination. The world out there is somehow controlling your internal neuronal dynamics, your brain dynamics, but at the same time, you are actually controlling the world out there. You are, you know, the world includes my eyes and moving things around. So that speaks to sort of, you know, another perspective on perception, that it is quintessentially active. It's more than just constructing predictions. We actually sample the world actively to gather evidence for our world models, for our generative models, to ensure that the predictions that we make are as veridical as possible.
Good. And I want to talk a bit later, a bit more about action. But before we get there, how should we think about conscious experience then on this picture? So for example, I'm looking at the table. I intuitively think the table is outside of my head. You're saying that it's not. How should we think about, is it floating around in my head somewhere? Is it a physical thing? Is it a non-physical sort of sense datum or something? What's your view on the metaphysics of perception?
My view is not terribly informed because I'm not a philosopher, but I will appeal to a lot of my friends who are philosophers. But first of all, I'll appeal to Helmholtz. So this picture of sense making, he termed unconscious inference. So there was no implication that we would be propositionally or explicitly aware that we were perceiving. So I think you have to bring something else to the table to talk about that kind of consciousness. My preferred sort of take on this phenomenology is that due to people like Thomas Metzinger, where there's different kinds of sense making that can be opaque or transparent. I can just see something, or I can know that I'm seeing something, which would be the opaque version, you know, as opposed to just seeing something through a transparent window. I now realize that I'm looking at a picture of something. So that sort of suggests that there are special kinds of systems, basically things like you and me, that have the ability to go beyond transparent sensation, transparent qualitative experiences, and actually know that you are looking at something. You're actually seeing your own perception on the inside. And that can be read in one of two ways. First of all, it immediately tells you that there is also internal action, internal perception, which means that the brain must have a hierarchical structure, the kind of hierarchies you'd see in deep learning, for example. So the very word deep means that there's a hierarchical depth. So one level of sense making can look at the level below and be informed by the level above. What does that mean in terms of psychology? Well, the way that one higher level of the brain will contextualize the sense making and the prediction error processing, the belief updating of a lower level, is by selecting the right newsworthy information that's going to resolve greatest uncertainty, minimize the prediction errors. So if you're a psychologist, it would be attention. So there's a deep link between the mechanics of sense making of the kind implied by Helmholtz, modern-day versions of this would be the Bayesian brain hypothesis, for example, and attention, which is not just accumulating evidence from the world and assimilating it and disambiguating between various hypotheses in your world model, but actually choosing what to ignore and what not to ignore in doing that. And that can be read, I repeat, as attention. And that now equips the brain with a kind of action on the inside, that you're actually doing stuff to all the message passing inside your brain, which I can't see you do, but you're still doing this. And that kind of mental action, I think, gets you now one step closer to the kind of conscious perception and awareness that we're talking about. It's not self-awareness. We don't know that we're doing this at this stage, but there is certainly an ability to actually act upon and render that which was transparent now opaque.
Okay, I think now might be a good time to introduce the free energy principle. So what a lot of what we've already said has been in that area, but can we now extend it to think about how the brain acts in the world and how we have behavior? And can you kind of link that with what you said about perception?
Right. Well, what we've been talking about is often what I often describe as a sort of low road to understanding sense making. The high road would be more that a physicist would take. So looking at what we've just said through the lens of physics and self-organizing systems, what we're saying is that any system, including particularly the brain, is in the game of minimizing its free energy, where free energy is now read as this prediction error or surprise. So it is the most stable, the most likely way of being. Mathematically, it's just called the principle of least action, where action is, if you like, the average free energy or the average prediction error or the average surprise. And that provides, if you like, a sort of a more general perspective on anything that self-organizes itself. The particular implications for the brain emphasize what we're talking about before, which is this bi-directional exchange with me and the world, in the following sense, that if I am wanting to minimize my surprise or prediction error or my free energy, or I can be described as so doing, then there are two ways that I can do that. I can either change my mind in order to make my predictions more like what I am sensing, and that resolves the prediction error. So this would be perception. But there's another way I can resolve prediction errors. That way would be the active way. That would be basically sampling a different kind of data, palpating the world with my eyes, with my fingers, in a different kind of way to select and sample those data that I predicted. And that equally would now not change the predictions, but it would change the thing predicting, but it would just minimize the prediction error. So now you have a seamless, monothematic, unitary explanation for both action and perception both in the service of minimizing the same thing, which mathematically, or from the physicist's perspective, would be free energy. From a predictive processing theoretician's point of view, would be prediction error. And once you look at it like that, you suddenly realize you're just talking about a fundamental phenomenon that characterizes all self-organization. If I was a physiologist, it would be just homeostasis. It would just be the tendency of all self-maintaining systems to limit their prediction errors in the sense of restricting deviations from their set points, homeostatic set points on their essential variables, to within acceptable bounds. So exactly the same phenomena can be applied to physiology and homeostasis. You could even now apply it to economics. You could say that things like expected utility theory is just an expression of rendering the world, making choices, acting upon the world in order to realize my predictions, usually optimistic predictions that I'm wealthy, loved, and have a certain temperature.
Can you give us a sense of the variety of these self-organizing systems? So obviously you have us human beings. Can you go down to the very small and then also the very large and just give us a sense of the range here?
Yeah, well, in principle, again, from the point of view of the free energy principle, it's turtles all the way down. So as soon as you can disambiguate anything from its milieu, its environment, the self in self-organization from the non-self, you induce technically what's something called a Markov blanket, a boundary that separates me from everything that's not me. And that definitional approach to thingness implies exactly a reading of free energy minimization that we've been talking about. So it's not saying that existing means that I am perceiving and acting, but what it does allow you to say is that in existing as separate from my environment, in existing in a way that I do not dissolve into or dissipate into the environment so that I maintain the integrity of the boundary between me and everything else. Just by existing, I am licensed to describe this thing as engaging in a free energy minimizing process, and therefore I can talk about it in terms of action and perception of a very elemental sort. So that would apply to anything. So if you've got a name for it, then it does this kind of thing. But clearly that's not a sufficient explanation for things like you and me. So there are different kinds of things. And when we get to sort of the level of things that are sufficiently large, interestingly, at the level things like quantum mechanics would no longer apply, but not so large that conservative dynamics and the motion of the heavenly bodies, say, kick in. But when we have this sort of intermediate scale, when we get sufficiently big, something really interesting happens. That the interface between me and not me that mediates the perception and the action, a sort of bi-directional traffic that does this entrainment and ensures this generalized synchronization, the active part becomes so removed from the inside of reasonably big things, you know, things of your size and my size, that action now becomes the cause of my sensation. And that's really interesting, because if action is now a cause of my sensation, and I can always describe something as inferring the causes of my sensation through this Bayesian brain or sense-making interpretation, that means that certain things, provided they are sufficiently big, are actually inferring their own actions. And that's interesting, because that in statistics or machine learning particularly, and also to a certain sense psychology, that means we move to a different natural kind that can plan. So planning is inference, inferring what is the most likely thing I am doing and what should I commit to and what should I select. So we now get this much deeper kind of action where you have on the inside the consequences of your own actions. So there's now a separation between what I'm physically doing, all my autonomic reflexes and the all the motoric reflexes that cause me to physically move, and what I think I am actually doing and what I am choosing to do, and thereby predicting what I'm going to do next. So I think at that level, planning would be definitive of the kinds of things that could possibly, say, be it called a true agent.
Right.
So, well, let me ask you, I mean, would you consider a thermostat an agent?
No.
Right. So, because a thermostat doesn't plan. But if I gave you a thermostat that actually planned its own future and was able to ask questions about what its own future would be like, I think it would then become sufficiently smart and agentic for you to start thinking of it as a thermostat. And of course, what I've just said is basically I'm equipping a thermostat, which is pure homeostasis, with implicitly a generative model or a world model of its own future, but crucially, a future that it can author by selecting different kinds of policies. And once I think you move to that kind of thing, then you've got a sort of a way of describing agents. And I think that you'd probably then argue that to be conscious is to be an agent. So you're not saying that all agents are conscious, but to be conscious would necessitate this kind of agency and this kind of deeply structured generative or world model.
Sure. And the free energy principle is holding all this together because all of this is in aid of minimizing free energy.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
So then what about a situation in which I imagine something which I have no intention of making true, right? So I imagine flying elephants or something. And then that's it. Haven't I maximized free energy in doing that? And how does the free energy principle accommodate that kind of case?
That's a lovely question. So the free energy principle, it's a principle. In physics, that means it's a method, so you can only apply it. So you'd apply it at different scales. So I think what we've been talking about in terms of perception, active inference, is an application at a particular scale, which is quite a fast time scale, over, say, several hundred milliseconds, the cognitive moment, for example, a fraction of a second. But you can also apply it over days and weeks in terms of learning. You can also apply it at the level of developmental psychology, for example, and also at an evolutionary scale. So there are many different levels at which you can apply it. Just to give you one simple example, in statistics, Bayesian model selection is the choice of the right kind of model based upon its free energy, that basically provides a score of the likelihood of this model accounting for these data, which you can read as adaptive fitness. So you can look at natural selection at an evolutionary timescale as Bayesian model selection, which is one instance of a free energy minimizing process. So that would be one application. I think the dreaming of flying elephants probably speaks to a timescale on within which you could fit, say, dreaming. So why is it that we spend a good 20, 30, 40% of our life with our eyes closed, dreaming in a fantastical way, sequestered from the actual world? You know, from a point of view of natural selection, you'd think this was a very precarious kind of policy to adopt. However, if you just look at what the free energy principle tells you about the imperatives for minimizing the free energy of me as a phenotype and me as a brain, then something really interesting happens. So the free energy can also be read as the complement to or the negative of something called log evidence or log marginal likelihood. It's just a measure of the plausibility that I am a good model of my world, a good world model that, you know, I can now make predictions that minimize free energy. Mathematically, you can decompose that, as a statistician would, into accuracy and complexity, which means that I can always describe anything, and in particular things like you and me, as striving to or appearing to model their world in a way that provides an accurate account as possible, but as simple as possible. So that means there's also an imperative to minimize complexity, to become wise and focused and sparse and non-redundant in the way that we understand our world. Mathematically, what that basically means is, if I had the opportunity to remove all the sensory data, I can take accuracy off the table. I don't need to account for these data because I'm asleep, or I'm closing my eyes, or I'm thinking about something. which just means I can still minimize free energy, but how would I do that? I do that by minimizing complexity. So what would that entail? It would basically entail getting rid of all the redundant associations as a neurophysiologist, all the synaptic connections, the wiring in our brains that I don't need. How would I do that? Well, I would basically see if I could explain some imaginal, some fantasy sensorium or sensory input that I myself created more simply. That is basically the argument for sleep, for dreaming, and one could also argue for many aspects of creative thought where paradoxically you're not necessarily creating anything new. What you're doing is saying, ah, that's just one of those. You're finding those cross-cutting themes, those simpler explanations, very much in the spirit of minimalism, for example. So I would contend that you flying the elephant is basically a way of just testing, do I need these constraints, these parameters, these contingencies that are installed in my brain and my generative model to explain stuff or not? And if you don't need them, as people like Giulio Tononi would say, you engage something called synaptic regression or pruning. So the idea is that when with our eyes open, we're engaging with the world, accumulating all sorts of explanations and associations, literally consolidating, reinforcing synaptic or wiring connections in the brain. And then we have a little break and say, did we really need all that? And then we have a house cleaning that minimizes the complexity so that we now have the best kind of model for tomorrow's experience, that thereby our models will then generalize and adapt and be appropriate for tomorrow's experience.
Can we turn to cases where things go a little bit wrong? So, for example, what about cases of known illusions? So sometimes you have a perceptual illusion, you're told that it's an illusion, you believe the person, and yet the illusion persists. So one would expect that your experience would then change to minimize free energy, and yet it doesn't. So can your picture kind of accommodate that, or is something going wrong with the way the brain's working there?
No, I think illusions are again, wonderful examples of the brain making sense of its sensed world based upon prior exposure and everything that it has learned. So on one view, illusions are basically a tool that psychophysicists can use to reveal the prior constructs, the structure of our generative models, our prior commitments and the constraints on the way that we make sense of things. So the person who's experiencing the illusion does not know it's an illusion. It's just the experimenter who's configured these stimuli to produce the illusion to reveal this particular prior belief. But your question is really interesting. Even if you tell somebody, that's not going to make any difference. You know, this is how the brain is making sense of things. It comes back to this notion that there's a divide between our actual qualitative experience that may be transparent, and that can be rendered opaque because we have some control. We know that we're attending to this and attending to that. But declarative knowledge, will not be able to penetrate these mechanisms. These are distributed mechanisms throughout the brain. So I think it's wonderful that you can't talk somebody out of an illusion. This is the way you are built. This is your reality. And this is a gift, not only of evolution, but all neurodevelopment and everything that you've accrued during your life.
I believe you began your career as a psychiatrist. And I think one of the really interesting ways in which you've applied the free energy principle is to thinking about mental illness. Could you say a bit about that and about some of the promising ways in which the principle might be able to be applied there?
Yes, and indeed much of this theoretical work was motivated by trying to understand, in particular, schizophrenia and psychosis. A brief answer is as follows, that the free energy principle is basically a methodology that allows you to talk about sense-making in terms of inference. What does that mean in the context of psychopathology? Well, it means you can now read psychopathology as false inference, and you can start to talk about both the physiological and pharmacological processes that underwrite false inference, which is basically bad belief updating. And that's really useful because there are two ways you can make a false inference. If you're a statistician, there'd be type one and type two errors. You can either infer something is there when it's not. That's a sort of a type one error, a positive error. And of course, that's a beautiful summary of hallucinations and delusions. I think it's something somebody's speaking to me when they're not actually speaking to me. But you can also have type two errors, inferring something is not there when it is. And of course, this would subsume what in the old days would be called hysteria or dissociative symptoms or neglect symptoms. So there's a vast range of psychiatric symptoms ranging from psychosis through to neglect symptoms. You could include attention deficit disorders within that as well, that fall nicely under this notion of false inference. So then you ask, what are the mechanisms? What are the process theories that are consistent with an application of the free energy principle that could possibly explain this kind of false inference? And it all comes back to what we were talking about before, which is this ability to act on the inside by selecting the newsworthy information, the prediction errors that drive my belief updating. If you get that wrong, then you are very, very susceptible to this kind of false inference. So you can look at this as a sort of mathematical attention disorder, a failure to ignore or a failure of the ability to ignore what is not relevant or informative, which suddenly calls for an explanation. So say I was watching television and I have this unignorable evidence from my body that is suggesting that there's some personal arousal that has been elicited by whatever's happening, and I happen to be watching the newscaster on the evening news. To explain this unattenuated information, I might have the hypothesis, which would be completely Bayes optimal, the newscaster is talking to me. He is talking to me personally, and we are engaged. So you can see how easy it would be to fall into a delusional system or bring false explanations to the table if you can't ignore the data at hand. So that would be one example.
Absolutely. Carl Friston, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.